You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 21st of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
US Secretary of State Antony Blinken embarks on another epic Middle Eastern schlep. Friends again, but can the Weimar Triangle of Germany, France and Poland stay that way? And French President Emmanuel Macron and the art of the self-beclowning photo op. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Quentin Peel and Nadine Batchelor-Hunt will discuss the day's big stories. And this week's letter from is a letter from Marrakesh. Stay tuned. All that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Nadine Batchelor-Hunt, who is a political reporter for Politics Home, and by Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow with the Europe Programme at Chatham House. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Greetings.
And an especially big hello to you, Quentin. You're back.
Hi.
You have been unwell.
I have. I was distracted by a slight, I suppose they would call it an issue with my heart, which seemed to give a bit of trouble, and I had to have a bit of open heart surgery.
Yeah, listeners, I know for a fact that Quentin is massively underselling this, because it did keep you out of action for quite some time.
Yes, I even missed Christmas. Anyway, but I had to spend 6 weeks in the care of the National Health Service before the operation. I was apparently too well to have the operation, but too sick to go home. So I was sort of caught in an awful bind.
Sounds like the opening lines of a really depressing country ballad. You should go home and pluck up your mandolin and work on that one. Excellent to see you back. And for our listeners, excellent to hear you back, I'm sure. Nadine, meanwhile, you, I believe, from our earlier conversation, are excited by some incipient young person's cultural occurrence.
Yes, the two new trailers for House of the Dragon dropped today, and I'm a huge A Song of Ice and Fire, George R.R. Martin fan. This is obviously the TV show based on his book Fire and Blood, which is about the Targaryen dynasty, and it's very exciting. It's all going to be kicking off.
Are you absolutely agog for this as well, Quentin? I've no idea what she's talking about.
The first I know about it, but I'm sure it will be exciting.
Okay, well, we will start in the Middle East, where US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is making yet another trip in search of a formula which might encourage the Middle East to cease Middle Easting with quite its present intensity. In Riyadh yesterday, Blinken met Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and will speak to Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi in Cairo today, before proceeding to Israel tomorrow, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is still insisting that a much-objected-to offensive against the southern Gaza city of Rafah is going to go ahead. Quentin, we're just easing you back in here with peace in the Middle East. The US is now, its line is an architecture for a lasting peace. Do we have the least idea what that might look like?
Not a lot. But there are small steps on the way. And I think the one thing that Antony Blinken has going for him on this trip is the resolution that the United States has just tabled in the United Nations calling for an immediate ceasefire. And that might just move things a tiny bit. But nonetheless, the best description I've heard about this trip from a real Middle East watcher was he was cautiously pessimistic.
Nadine, the US has been getting noticeably less patient in recent weeks with Israel, but balancing against that and that activity at the UN, I'm just wondering if you think they may be trying, not that the Israelis can necessarily see it, to throw Israel a bone. There's also been a line from Blinken's spokesman at the State Department, who was talking about coordination post-conflict planning for Gaza, including ensuring Hamas can no longer govern or repeat the attacks of October 7th. So is there now a consensus, not just within Israel, but among the United States, and actually probably, if we're honest, among the rest of the Middle East, that Hamas are done for?
I mean, it's hard to see how they kind of come back from this. You know, Gaza the infrastructure in Gaza is decimated. Hamas's infrastructure is going to have been decimated. I mean, Israel is still fighting them, you know, coming up to 200 days into this war now. But yeah, it doesn't seem as though Hamas having some sort of future in Gaza is on the table for many kind of people that are important in international diplomacy now. Whereas before they were just kind of there and people just kind of tolerated them. It seems like a line was crossed on the 7th of October, which has kind of made their continued existence untenable. But I'm also kind of pessimistic because the signalling we're seeing from Netanyahu's government doesn't indicate that they kind of are looking towards some sort of long-term peaceful settlement. We have to remember, this is somebody who doesn't want to see a Palestinian state and has said as such.
He does not.
So this always has to... whenever we have conversations about this kind of long-term sustainable peace in Palestine and Israel, it has to be taken with the reality on the ground, which is leadership in both Palestine and Israel isn't particularly good. And on the Israeli side, there is no real desire to have a Palestinian state among a pretty hard right government. So I am always quite pessimistic when we talk about this, given the current leadership in those two countries. I just don't see... My view is that there's going to have to be kind of a new government in both to kind of have any sort of sustainable peace. But with what's gone on in Gaza and the humanitarian crisis there and the kind of the severe loss of life, I feel like peace is a very long way away.
Quentin, that's probably true, everything Nadine says there, certainly about the necessity of new leadership in both countries. Obviously, within Israel, that is up to the Israeli people at the next of their relatively frequent general elections. But there is still the unanswered question of who or what is going to govern Gaza, because presumably somebody at some point is going to have to. As we've been saying, there does appear to be consensus that it won't be Hamas or any sort of Hamas successor. Blinken is still pitching the idea of the Palestinian Authority, which can barely govern the West Bank, being the government in Gaza. Now, on the one hand, Blinken might well be thinking, well, who else is there? And I don't have an answer to that question myself. But it doesn't sound that likely, does it? But not least because the people of Gaza have not shown the least interest in being governed by the Palestinian Authority. And I can't imagine it's going to look good for the Palestinian Authority if they are perceived as an Israeli puppet.
Yeah. The only time I've ever actually visited Israel was the year in which Hamas won the elections in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority won the elections in the West Bank. And it was a very clear division between them. I may say the really shocking thing at the time I found was that almost all the Israelis I talked to said, oh, we don't care who wins. This is irrelevant to us. And of course, the answer was it was Hamas, which is now seen as the devil incarnate. Very difficult to get the Arab states, I think, to really rally round and put their weight behind a solution with the Palestinian Authority. I'm not sure there's going to be any enthusiasm there, but particularly not given that, as Nadine said, you've got a very hard-line Israeli government and Netanyahu who doesn't want a two-state solution.
He's also said he doesn't want the Palestinian Authority governing Gaza.
Yeah, absolutely.
He has not as yet himself furnished any coherent ideas as to who or what he thinks should govern Gaza. But looking back at Gaza, Nadine, there has been fighting in and around Rafah. The much-threatened, full-blown Israeli onslaught against Rafah has not occurred just yet. Netanyahu keeps saying it's going to. Whether or not he actually wants to be talked out of this, is there, from his point of view, or at least if he's thinking clearly from his point of view, is there perhaps value to some sort of relatively magnanimous gesture at this point?
Potentially, but I think what is likely, and I kind of follow quite a few Israeli political commentators online, and what has floated as a suggestion is what Netanyahu may be doing is we're seeing a lot more pushback from Washington at the moment in terms of what Israel's doing, a harsher rhetoric, being kind of, you know, more firm on the need to protect civilian lives. There was obviously the setup of that kind of seaport to get aid in. And so what Netanyahu may decide to kind of go down is say, well, we wanted to do a full assault of Rafah, but actually America is suggesting or indicating, you know, you had Chuck Schumer on the floor of the House in Congress saying, you know, we need a new administration essentially in Israel. He may then say, well, I wanted to do more in Rafah, but I couldn't because America seemed to be wavering. So I think it's kind of benefiting him in a way, that kind of US harshness, because he may try and capitalise on that to avoid a devastating attack on Rafah. And when I say devastating, I mean for the Palestinians, it would be dire. We have to remember that many people, around 1 million people, are taking refuge there, over 1 million people. An assault on that, which is so densely populated, Gaza was densely populated anyway before mm-hmm. those refugees fled south. It's the last enclave where people are able to kind of have any inverted commas safety, if you can call anywhere safe in Gaza. So if you can avoid that and then also say, well, I actually wanted to completely vanquish Hamas, but I couldn't because the Americans stopped me, that's a kind of get out of way thing for him. So there's also that to consider in his strategy, because one thing you can't underestimate with Netanyahu is his will to survive politically.
And yeah, we've noticed.
Year after year after year, he remains, and everyone can't believe he's still not in jail, and maybe one day he will be, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's on the, a strategy on the cards.
Well, to Europe now, and the defeat of Poland's Law and Justice Party in last October's election, and the return to Poland's Prime Minister's office of Donald Tusk, were greeted in most European capitals with an enthusiasm which verged on the actually tactless. One practical consequence of Tusk's restoration has been a revival of the idea of the Weimar Triangle, a diplomatic grouping bringing together France, Germany and Poland. Tusk met French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz in Berlin last week for what were hopefully some constructive discussions in between weirdly ardent hand clasping for the benefit of photographers. Quentin, do these three countries actually have all that much in common beyond sort of adjoining each other?
They have quite a lot of differences, undoubtedly, and particularly on what obviously absolutely the top of their agenda, which is Ukraine. I mean, on Ukraine, you have a very clear line from Donald Tusk and the Poles. They want Ukraine to win.
That's been the one thing that was never going to change, however Poland voted.
Right. Having said that, the line from Macron is he doesn't want the Russians to win. From Mr. Scholz, you don't even get the word win ever used. All he says is we're in there for the long run. Now, having said all that, Scholz is actually fessing up a lot of financial and indeed mm-hmm. military support, although not the one key thing that the Ukrainians are asking for now, long-range missiles. Macron has given much less support, but does give some long-range missiles. So it's a very interesting situation where I think Donald Tusk is actually critical, because the French and the Germans have been bickering, really, about the right strategy for Ukraine. And just recently, Macron came out and said, we may have to send soldiers, we may have to put boots mm-hmm. on the ground.
Various Polish officials have said something broadly similar as well.
But Scholz is horrified.
Oh, absolutely.
And so there was that very clear split between them, which Tusk may be the man to try and bring them together. After all, they know him very well. This was the man who was president of the European Council for a long time, and so seen as a good European, and just as you were saying, greeted back in the Prime Minister's office in Poland with enormous relief that we've no longer got that ghastly Kaczynski to deal with, who was such a nationalist and so right-wing.
Is there also an element here, Nadine, of France and Germany trying to I'm not really sure how you would characterise the relationship, perhaps trying to smother with kindness a country they worry about becoming Europe's actual coming principal military power. And Poland is now heading for 4% of its GDP on defence, and obviously its GDP right now is not comparable to France or Germany's, but nonetheless, and they want a standing military of 300,000 troops. Poland is going to become an increasingly serious country, and I do wonder just deep down where they live how actually delighted France and Germany are by that prospect.
Yeah, I mean, that probably is going into the thinking, and I think, you know, we've had peace in Europe for a long time, but obviously, well, not a long time, if you obviously with Russia, but I mean, you know, we've not had the kind of conflicts in Europe that we saw in the kind of the 1930s and 1940s for a long time. So, you know, it's definitely going to be on their minds. But I also think Poland are obviously very much on the front lines. And also Poland as a country has seen so much in terms of war. I've got one of my best friends is Polish, and the stories he tells me about his parents and his grandparents, about what they saw there. So it's a country that is very much in many ways living in the kind of trauma of the USSR and Russia, etc. So it does make sense that they are bolstering it up. But it's a conversation that isn't just happening now, it's happening here as well. You know, in the Conservative Party, there is growing calls for a ramping up of spending of GDP, on defence, and it probably become a bigger issue post the next election. So I think, you know, Poland is reflecting a sort of a trend that we'll probably start seeing spread across Europe of spending more on defence for GDP, as a percentage of GDP, because it has fallen down the agenda, but the world is changing, be it Russia and Ukraine, obviously we've got China, and obviously the omnipresent threat of North Korea. The world is becoming a more unstable place, so I think Poland are a bit ahead of the game on this, but I wouldn't be surprised in 10 years' time if many countries across Europe are making similar decisions.
But this is going to further... I don't know whether it's a schism or a rebalancing, Quentin, but... There have been, of course, these conflicts between new Europe and old Europe in the last couple of years. The threat from Russia gets taken progressively more seriously the closer you get to Russia's border, and perfectly understandably. But do you think those old EU powers like France and Germany, France in particular, are altogether prepared for the fact that there will be a significant military counterweight in the east of the continent? And obviously we're all on the same side here, but nonetheless, a country like Poland... And certainly Ukraine, when it joins the EU, is going to want to be heard and is going to want to be taken seriously and is going to deserve to be taken seriously.
And is going to be heavily militarised, of course, because of the war. That's a problem. I think that really it's as much the financial problem that they face, because if Ukraine joins the European Union, and Poland's already shown it, they have a huge farming sector which gets an awful lot of money out of Europe, which means less for countries like France and Germany. So there's a tension there. The other tension, I think, the realistic tension was, I think it's Radek Sikorski who told me, the now foreign minister again, and he said, you know, the trouble with you Brits and the difference between you and us is that when you think about war, you think about sending tanks to foreign countries. When we think about war, we mean tanks in our own streets. And that's the difference between, if you like, the spending, the military spending that's coming up. It's going to make NATO potentially a much more forceful organisation and not just a bunch of rather European wimps with a heavy America.
Just finally on this one then, Nadine, coming back to the idea of the Weimar Triangle, do you think there is a value to these kind of informal blocks within blocks? Because on the one hand, this does seem a bit superfluous, verging in fact on the childish, given that all three of these countries are already members of the EU and members of NATO, and I'm sure members of Lord knows what other organisations that they can all get together and talk to each other at. Is it helpful if three of them had decide we're going to form our own little club, no Belgians allowed?
Yeah, I don't really get the kind of the point of that. I mean, in some ways it guarantees furthering of conversations and more news coverage and kind of rather than waiting for summits at specific times, you can have more regular dialogue between nations that may not otherwise have as much engagement. But it does seem quite odd and a bit maybe anachronistic given the way things are at the moment. But no, it'll be interesting to see how it develops.
Well, I think, you see, it's classic European politics, because European politics is all about caucusing. And it's all about caucusing before the big meetings, and just what you were saying, something the Brits never really got. And that's where I think it does have a role to play, that actually bringing the Poles into this vital relationship between the French and the Germans was a big gesture and could be absolutely critical in the future.
Well, let's stay in Germany. And many years ago, at around the peak of the Eurozone crisis, Germany's then Chancellor Angela Merkel gave a characteristically thoughtful speech in which, drawing on the unhappy history of her own country, she reminded that a currency collapse can, in extremis, lead to upheaval and conflict. The choleric British tabloid The Daily Express responded with the magnificent front page headline, "Germany warns of war in Europe." Similar hijinks may yet be inspired by a recent utterance by Germany's education minister, Bettina Stark-Watzinger, to the effect that German school kids should be inculcated with greater resilience to crisis. She cited natural disasters, pandemics, and that thing which the wisdom of British sitcoms cautions us not to to mention. Quentin, as an old-school Fleet Street type yourself, are we disappointed that the Express has not run with Germany teaches its children to fight?
Perhaps they haven't noticed, or perhaps they don't read German. But having said that, it is fascinating that the German psyche has shifted, clearly. Mm. I always was so conscious of Germany being very pacifist, deeply pacifist. And now suddenly they've been knocked off that comfort zone, knocked out of that comfort zone, and are having to think about the possibility of real, you know, bloody warfare, and as opposed to warfare over the euro or anything. but I think that that's extraordinary. Now, the minister in question is a member of the Free Democrats,
indeed,
who are on the right and somewhat nationalist side, whereas the pacifists now seem to be very much concentrated in the Social Democratic Party, keeping Chancellor Scholz very hesitant about really committing himself in Ukraine or being really anti-Russian. So there is still a significant leftover of pacifism in Germany, but slowly and not very surely, they're actually getting to think about the reality of war coming back.
Well, Nadine, Germany is an obviously extreme example due to its history, but it's a bit like, you know, you were saying, talking about this earlier, the slightly shifting mood on this stuff within Europe. And does Europe as a whole, especially the EU, need to maybe lay off the self-congratulation about, you know, 80 years or whatever it is we're up to now of relative peace among the European nations, and admit to itself that, well, to paraphrase Leon Trotsky, war has not yet ceased taking an interest in us?
Yeah, I do think so. And it is quite bemusing to see the kind of, the Germans could be learning to fight again. It's kind of like, it's very different. The context is very, very different. And, you know, obviously, that's not to say that, you know, World War II wasn't terrible, World War I wasn't terrible, but we're in a very different world now, and the way that any kind of war would pan out would unlikely see the sort of kind of troops that we saw historically because of modern weapons or whatever. But I do think it is symbolic of this new era. I think recently a military chief in the UK as well said, you know, conscription may be something that has to be started to be considered in this country. And I think it's a scary new world. As a young person, it's just not been great, I'm not going to lie. Just looking at like the future and what it holds, if it's not climate change, it's this. But, you know, there is something stark about, you know, Germany in inverted commas remilitarising if they needed to. But I don't like this kind of expressism of kind of sensationalism, but I do take a lot of joy reading the front page of the Express because their headlines are always pretty hilarious, particularly on Brexit. It's always like Brexit dividends pays off, and there's actually nothing particularly great happening.
It would be exciting to spend a few months living on the Daily Express's planet, I've always thought. Quentin, more soberingly though, do you sense, not just from this, but from, and we were talking about this earlier, remarks made by French and Polish politicians recently, and certainly among the Scandinavians and the Baltics, that there is some kind of gathering resignation that Ukraine is not going to be the end of it?
Yeah, I think that's the real worry, certainly of the Poles, but it's Macron has expressed the same worry that Putin won't stop there. And of course, the biggest worry of all are those tiny little countries that we love dearly, the three Baltic republics, who've been fantastic members of the European Union and of NATO and so on. They could be overrun by the Russians in days, if we're not careful. So I think that's what really creates deep concern. Now we're seeing that, you know, this extraordinary backlash against Putin that has brought both Finland and Sweden into NATO, something I never expected to see in my lifetime, these deeply neutral countries. And that's where Putin's got it wrong, I think. But having said that, who is to say that he will stop there? Because he sort of turned Russia into a newly remilitarized country in a huge way.
Just finally on this one, Nadine, and as the person at this table and I suspect by some margin, who was at school most recently. What do you think of the German education minister's idea that the Bundeswehr, the German military, should be encouraged to do greater outreach into schools? Where is the balance there between being seen to indoctrinate these poor, wide-eyed infants versus preparing them for reality?
I'm quite anti that sort of stuff. I think schooling should be kept separate to military service. I think if you're going to have a country where you want to introduce military service, then do it. But I think outreach into schools in that kind of way can become a bit, I don't know. And obviously every country to its own. But I just think it's a sign of the times that even that is being floated. And I wonder if the public across, you know, namely Western Europe, I think, you know, towards Eastern Europe, they get it. Like, and I think the point you made about how, you know, tanks seeming this kind of foreign thing in many ways, we World War II and World War I, we didn't have German tanks rolling down Trafalgar Square or Piccadilly Circus or whatever. So we don't have that. And I do wonder if in Western Europe, to some extent, particularly here, we haven't really clocked on as to what this could mean. And I think perhaps, and I hope this doesn't happen, but perhaps in 10 years' time we'll look back and be like, oh, weren't we naive? But I hope that's not the case.
The phony war of 2024. We will move along, though, stay in France, where not for the first time, President Emmanuel Macron has contributed greatly, if not necessarily deliberately, to the global gaiety by attempting to butch up his image somewhat. A couple of years back, listeners may recall, in an almost touchingly wistful act of Volodymyr Zelensky cosplay, Macron went to some pains to be photographed unshaven, which must have taken him a while, and wearing a hoodie bearing the emblem of France's 10th Air Parachute Commando, a unit for which slightly built 5.5-footers rarely pass muster. This time, Macron has released gritty black and white photos of himself pummeling a punch bag. Leaving aside, Quentin, the question of Macron's effectiveness as a president, he's quite a weird little guy, isn't he?
Who is advising him about this? The best comment that I've seen is the instant thought that the photographs must have been photoshopped to give him bigger biceps than he really has. I mean, the whole thing was really quite peculiar.
Well, that's one of the peculiarities of it, Nadine, because first there is the general, what on earth are you thinking, who is this going to impress bit, but there is also the fact that, is it a smart idea to release photographs of this sort into a social media storm about doctored photos? I mean, the jokes told themselves.
I find it really interesting that he's done this. And you know, we saw a lot of this sort of stuff with Boris Johnson, not so much the kind of black and white thing, but he was wearing boxing gloves and he'd be punching a boxing one of those gym bags, and we also saw Keir Starmer doing something similar. But you know, it's kind of common in countries like Russia and North Korea to see leaders doing this. And I wonder, as populism, you know, he is grappling with a kind of rise of right-wing populism in France. Maybe this is the kind of thing he thinks people are looking for, these kind of images of like a strong leader. Maybe that's in response to that. But, you know, as we are in a kind of in Kategate with Dr. Photos, it is an unusual time to release. And I imagine there are a lot of memes about it circulating.
Oh, no, endless. Seriously, it's an evening's entertainment. I got quite distracted writing this bit of the script. Quentin, as a long-time observer, as you are, of the political circus, why do they do this?
I don't know. I think that they don't have people who can calm them down at moments of excessive excitement. But people say, go on, sir, you're one of them, you know, punch the hell out of them. And just very weird and guaranteed. I mean, the other comment that I read about it was somebody who said, well, when I saw these pictures, I instantly assumed it was somebody's joke about the president and was really shocked when I discovered that these were official pictures put out.
I mean, I do have a friend who, for a period, worked at an extremely senior level in political communications in the United Kingdom and did once tell me that roughly 95% of his job consisted of saying to various politicians, no, no, you can't, no, we're not doing that, no, no, stop doing that, no, that's a bad idea, no, no, never going to happen. But to bring this back to the United Kingdom, Nadine, and your particular beat, it does strike me that the current Prime Minister of this United Kingdom, and I am just checking that is still the case. Rishi Sunak is kind of an inadvertent master of the completely inept photo opportunity. Everything he tries to do in terms of staging a photo, and again, this is not necessarily a judgment on his capacities as a politician or a human being, it just always looks weird.
Yeah, I mean, there was that photo that he did with, it wasn't necessarily a kind of stage photo, but he was out with James Cleverly and David Cameron, and he's significantly shorter than both of them. One of them is a former prime minister, and it did look like he was a staffer.
In fairness, most of us standing next to James Cleverly and David Cameron would look somewhat slight. They are two big fellas.
Yeah, but he did look a bit like a sixth former on a school trip. So I think there is a problem with Number 10's comms. I think the Diane Abbott saga we saw last week, mm-hmm. Where it took Downing Street every 24 hours to call something that was clearly racist. Mm-hmm. There is a problem, and I think we'll see a lot more faux pas, but it just seemed to be that they do keep rolling out strange photos, like him in front of flip charts that could easily be photoshopped, and you're just kind of like, no. Like, if you were there comms, you would say, as your friend probably did many times, no, don't do that, that's a bad idea.
But what a contrast it is to that predecessor of his, do I remember the name, Boris Johnson, who actually made such a success of making himself look silly.
Yes.
I mean, quite extraordinary. He turned it round on its head. Maybe Rishi Sunak is trying to do the same.
Well, on that conundrum, Quentin Peel and Nadine Batchelor-Hunt, thank you both for joining us. Finally, on today's Daily, it is time for our letter from, and today our contributor Charlie Filmer-Court brings us this letter from Marrakesh.
If you could pick anywhere in the world to rest and recuperate, where would you choose? A Greek island? A beach in Bali? An alpine chalet? Or perhaps just the comfort of your own home? For those of you who have experienced the buzz of the Marrakesh Medina, it is unlikely that it would have come into consideration as a destination. Yet based on my recent experience being holed up in the city whilst recovering from the flu, it perhaps should. Taking a walk through the Marrakesh Medina is an assault on the senses. Its tiny labyrinthine lanes are filled to bursting point with all manner of sights and sounds. Sparks fly from workshops, smells emerge from kitchens, bakeries and spice stalls. It was this that drew me to the city in the first place, and it was this that I enjoyed thoroughly before falling ill a matter of days into the trip. This energy and vibrancy is what gives Marrakesh its allure. However, for someone feeling rather fragile, it sadly wasn't the most alluring prospect on this particular visit. As the Marrakesh Medina is almost 1,000 years old, I was by no means the first person to have been faced with such a problem. In fact, as I was to find out, much of the city's residential architecture has been designed with exactly this respite in mind. It's why, when walking down its winding roads, you'd be hard-pressed to see anything that gives even a clue as to what lies behind the endless rows of walls, shops, and stalls. Yet almost every time I emerged through the unassuming wooden doors dotted across the city, I was met with relaxing spaces built around opulent open-air courtyards that could not contrast more with the streets I had just left. Most of these buildings were once residential. However, today they serve as everything from Riyadh-style guest houses to restaurants to museums. And whilst their purposes may now vary, they retain many of the characteristics that have made them oases of calm for centuries worth of visitors, not least this weary traveller. One of the most notable characteristics was noise, in that often there was none. Sat in the middle of an open-air courtyard mere metres away from packed streets, you would expect to be able to hear the hum of motorbikes and the thrum of the crowd. However, thick walls and an absence of exterior windows mean you are blissfully unaware of your surroundings, if that's what you so wish to be. Another prominent characteristic is the impressive amounts of plants. Outside of the Medina, Marrakesh boasts a number of beautiful public parks and gardens. However, in this densest part of the city, green space is at a premium, meaning plants, vines, and vast trees can often be found in interior courtyards instead. As I sat in these bird-filled breathing spaces and nursed myself back to health with copious amounts of mint tea, I began to think about what techniques I could borrow from Marrakesh in order to try and replicate this tranquility at home. And whilst transforming my local neighbourhood's architectural style, or installing a vast palm in my minuscule garden, would both be nice. They're probably at the more difficult end of the home renovation spectrum. There was, however, one small attention to detail that even I could manage to replicate at home. The smell. Buildings across the city often use cleverly placed oil burners to create a wonderful perfumed atmosphere. Every small ledge or nook seems to have its own specific scent. And it was rare to even find a staircase that didn't emanate an orange blossom pick-me-up. I was so inspired by this, that since returning home I've perhaps taken it too far. The flickering oil burners in my house can now look more akin to a lighter-raising festival crowd than the Riyadh that inspired me. And it's here back at home that I've been wondering about how different my trip would have been had I not been ill. And whilst I regret not being able to make it to the Atlas Mountains, or to try the culinary delights of the so-called Lamb Alley, I'm actually really glad to have experienced this other side to the city that otherwise would have passed me by. For Monocle, I'm Charlie Filmercourt.
Thank you, Charlie. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Quentin Peel and Nardine Batchelor-Hunt. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.